Welcome to the Chief AI Officer Podcast, where AI meets leadership. And here is your host, Sanjay Puri.
Welcome to the CAIO Podcast, where we explore the ever-evolving landscape of AI by engaging with the industry's top AI executives. In today's episode, we have a special guest, Rodrigo Madanas, a seasoned AI executive who has played a pivotal role in driving AI innovation across multiple organizations. Rodrigo serves as the Global AI Innovation Officer at Ernst & Young, where he successfully deployed a company-wide Gen AI platform within 6 months and reset the corporate AI strategy as the former Interim Chief AI Officer. He's an MIT and Berkeley alumnus with over 25 years of experience at tech giants like Apple, eBay, Oracle, Skype, and now EY. Rodrigo, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for talking to our listeners who make up other chief AI officers, aspiring chief AI officers, policymakers. So let's get started. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about your journey that brought you to becoming the global innovation leader at Ernst & Young?
Sure. So I started my career very much in tech. So I studied computer science, and then I worked at technology companies like Oracle. And then what ended up happening is that early in my career, I knew I wanted to do AI, to work on AI. So part of my computer science degree was working with some of the AI leaders at the time. And then I worked at eBay and Skype, and I always knew that AI was an interest of mine. So I was building product in a tech company. I was like, there has to be more. AI would be very interesting to work on. And the opportunity rose to join Ernst & Young in the innovation capacity. And I was always drawn to the AI projects internally. So when the opportunity arose to lead the efforts globally for AI, I raised my hand and I said, I'd love that role. So I think one of the things to know for the listeners who are earlier in their career is raise your hand. When an opportunity comes up, you want to pursue to show your interest. And I did that role on an interim basis and then on a permanent basis to try to reset our AI strategy. But that's how I got here. I basically worked in tech, moved into more innovation roles, joined a larger company, and I raised my hand saying that would be a great role. Could I do that?
Well, you made a great point. And again, for our listeners who are looking to grow up to be Rodrigo, is raise your hands and do not be afraid of challenges. Rodrigo, generally, I would say, unless you've been living under a rock, most people know what Ernst & Young is. What does the role of global innovation leader at Ernst & Young imply? Just for our listeners who are trying to figure out what this means.
So Ernst, just to give the preset, Ernst & Young is a professional services firm. We have around 400,000 professionals who work in our tax, our audit, and our consulting practices. And what the role of an AI innovation leader entail is you focus on the early stage funnel of what you can do with AI. You create prototypes, you create proof of concepts, you flesh out, if you will, a product, an AI-oriented product, or you infuse AI into an existing product, and you take it up to a certain level of scale. In tech companies, this is sometimes called zero to one innovation, where you take something that doesn't exist and you take it to level one, and then other teams take it from one to 10, where they scale it up at scale, and then you need much more robust industrialization processes. So that's what I focus on across our portfolio of technologies at UI. I focus on the zero to one innovation on AI, either new products or infusing AI into existing products to make our people more productive and increase the quality.
So, Rodrigo, fair to say you're inwardly focused? You don't interface with clients of ENY?
That's right. My focus is mostly internal. I do interface with some customers externally, but my role is not primarily to drive consulting, let's say. There are other people who have those roles that are driving, helping our customers succeed in a consulting capacity on AI. I focus on our internal transformation, if you will.
So that's good to know. So in terms of scaling AI in enterprise setting, and you've done some of that, what can you talk to your peers about some of the obstacles you face when scaling Gen AI at EY? You did that in 6 months, and some of your peers are right now engaged in trying to do that.
Sure. So scaling is hard. The story that I tend to tell is you got to think in terms of eras of AI post, if you will, the November 2022 release of ChatGPT. So 2023 was mostly a year when most of us were doing proof of concepts and prototypes because scaling in an enterprise setting is really hard. What we started doing and what I've been recommending people in 2023 is to build out the scaling muscle. That means you need to develop a lot of interlock with different teams. So you got to interlock with your legal organization, with your risk management teams, all your compliance teams, because there's a lot of trade-offs in scaling AI and a lot of concerns that you need to make sure you follow that process. And then you need to connect the technology teams with the business teams, with the customer facing team. So there's a lot of interlock and cross-functional work you need to do to be able to scale up. Building pilots and prototypes is much easier because typically there's very few users or none. You're just trying to prove that technology works. But once you're going to start impacting the enterprise at scale, you got to bring the entire company on that journey. And that means having these participants with you from the beginning so they don't become roadblocks at the end of the journey, if you will.
So, Rodrigo, you make some very, very important points for our listeners because a lot of people think, hey, the CIO, you know, data science, you know, ML, you know, that's a slam dunk. But what you are telling our listeners is it needs really a multidisciplinary approach. So if I'm an aspiring chief AI officer, or I'm a current chief AI officer who's been put in this role, you're saying you need to know compliance, you need to know legal, you need to know, you know, other aspects of, you know, maybe change management and things of that nature. How, when you look at some of the priorities, recently a study came out from CIOs or C-level execs, the top three things they were talking about is governance and compliance, and they talked about security, return on investments. How important is it? Because these chief AI officers don't come, at least traditionally, with that background. So how do they learn those things? How did you get adept at that? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. In fact, so I tend to know a lot of, you know, people in the AI community. Mm-hmm. And what seems to be happening today is that often a company that doesn't have a CAIO will elevate their head of data science, let's say, into that role. And then that's a big challenge because, as you say, they come with a different repertoire of skills. They're missing a lot of the change management, the evangelism, the fundraising, the compliance aspect. The other thing that's happening is you have transformation officers sort of adopting the role of AI officer because they come with the repertoire of change management skills. They're just lacking the AI domain. And some companies are trying to combine them. I tend to think of the CAIO role a little bit as an orchestra conductor, where you were not going to be a great violin player. You are not the great pianist. You're just trying to make the whole company work well and fire on all cylinders on AI, which means you need to be connected to all these people who do know their role, like the pianist or the violin player, to just make it all work. My recommendation for aspiring CAIOs is to be open-minded about the learnings and the muscles you're going to have to develop as you elevate to a more leadership role where your job is not to execute the technical aspects of data science, but rather to be the interface between the executive team or the CEO and the rest of the organization. And you're going to be more trying to bring the company together. So develop those skills, because that's really what the what I'm seeing a lot, the shape of those roles I'm seeing today for CAIO, which is more of a bring the company together, orchestrate. You will have a team, but it's not a standalone team like, say, analytics, where you're like, oh, here's analytics, here are, you know, 50 analytics professionals, go do the ETL, get the database, give me the report. This is a much more senior role in the vein of a transformation officer, where you're orchestrating change across the enterprise. And like you say, the questions you're going to get asked is from the CFO, what's the ROI? How do I manage the budget? Is that the right level of budget? And you're going to get asked from the CEO, do you have the resources you need? What can I unblock? So it's just a different type of role than the data scientist leader role, if you will.
Again, you made some fantastic points. You need to be an orchestra conductor, not the best violinist, so to speak. You need to have good learning muscles so that you can learn quite a bit. And the thing that comes across, Rodrigo, is that how important is it to have C-level support or board-level support for this kind of a role? That's one of the questions that they ask, because, as you said, this is really a transformational role. So talk to our audience a little bit about that.
Yeah, thank you, Sanjay. I'm sure you have more visibility over so many CAIOs, and you've seen different shapes to the role in different organizations. Right now, the role is emerging across all organizations. So we're at the beginning of this journey, if you will. Mm-hmm. So you'll see different organizations shape the CIO role differently. Some will shape it small, meaning, mm-hmm. oh, we're just going to give the title and that person is going to sit under the technology engineering organization as a sub-function. So that's really more of a leader of data scientist role. And other organizations have a broader mandate where they're elevating the role to report either to the CEO or to some other flavor of executive. And there, yes, they are giving board encouragement. In fact, they would want to have the CIO, a candidate, talk to the board first to make sure there's endorsement. The board will review the strategy and will want frequent reports on how the AI strategy is playing out. In fact, I recently wrote an article for the Financial Times agenda. It's precisely on how should boards engage with the executive team and the CIO on driving the AI strategy. So it's definitely something we're seeing a lot of engagement on AI from boards and executive teams.
So Rodrigo, to some of our listeners who sit on boards, Fortune 500 boards, or are CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, what would your recommendation be? Hide them under a data science kind of a thing, or have C-level access, or it depends?
If you elevate up as to why do we have these roles in the first place, it's the reason why these roles exist is because AI is a very disruptive technology with a large opportunity on multiple sides of the way enterprises function. And because of the size of the opportunity and the potential that your competitors might adopt it faster or more efficiently or more effectively. It's become one of the top topics for CEOs and boards. So in order to organize the entire enterprise around this question and this opportunity, that's why the role exists. What would happen if you make it a much smaller role under, say, a data science team and you simply change their title, is that you as an enterprise will probably still be missing some strategic initiatives and some impact. So you're, in some sense, downgrading the importance of AI for your industry or for your company. You can do that. That's at your peril, if you will. But the role is simply to fulfill the function of the thesis, which is AI will disrupt our industry and or our enterprise. What do we do about that as fast as possible?
So what you're saying is really, if you want to take advantage of the strategic opportunities of a disruptive technology, then position it accordingly. That's what Rodrigo's message is to our listeners who are, you know, CEOs or board members. That's very helpful. One of the questions, Rodrigo, that came from one of your peers is that they struggle with showing the ROI on this, whether it's tangible, intangible. So the question was, how have you been able to internally, and what do you recommend in terms of figuring out the ROI for? Because some of these are expensive things, and maybe the payoff is not that immediate. So some feedback to your peers on that.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. To be elevating or going meta on that question, mm-hmm. ROI is a big topic these days within AI circles. And I see it as a positive thing, that type of scrutiny, because what it means is that we are now investing larger amount of dollars and the CFOs are coming around saying, hey, you're getting a big chunk of the budget. Help me understand what we're getting out of it. So it's a very healthy state to be in. It seems like we are maturing the function. I don't think we have yet cracked the code on ROI. I think the first things one should look at is engagement, which is, are people using it? And that's a proxy for ROI, which means people use stuff that is useful internally in the enterprise setting. So let's talk about the internal use cases first, as opposed to the customer-facing use cases, in part because many of the use cases today in enterprise are internal because they're less risky.
Yeah.
So on the ROI setting, the proxies one looks at are, do I have high engagement at scale? And the other one is there's a lot of qualitative work one can do, which is both creating champion networks where you get 20 or 50 users and you interview them and you understand the impact and you try to understand what are, how efficient this makes them do, what, how they've changed their work practices, and also do larger scale surveys to ask. The one, it works a bit by vertical. We have some data on ROI from industry, a lot of data on the ROIs on software development. So Gen AI on software development is very mature. There's been a number of studies on productivity for programmers that use Gen AI tools. So in that vertical, we have good data on ROI. On customer service or contact centers, we are starting to get good data, public data and some private data where you do a before and after and you measure. Because contact centers are so metrics oriented in terms of time to complete requests, a satisfaction score from the employee and from the customer, we're able to then tag the success or the ROIs from those deployments. For other areas where the work is harder to, it's not typically measured as much, then the ROIs are harder to pin down. So we're on a journey. on some verticals, it's easier. Some horizontals or verticals are easy to measure. Try to measure engagement. That should be a good proxy. And do qualitative surveys from champion networks or broader surveys across the enterprise to learn.
So I think, Rodrigo, what you're saying is, obviously engagement is important. Do surveys with champion networks. And the other thing you're saying is have some patience because we are just on a journey. Now, as you said, we have some early feedback on software development, maybe contact centers, but GenAI is now being used across the board. There was a follow-on question by a peer on this is, how does Rodrigo pick use cases? Because they said they have literally hundreds of use cases, but they can't, there are not enough resources. So how do you pick use cases and what would be your advice to your peers in terms of how to pick the best use cases?
So I think the first strategy is do that work, meaning do create an aggregation of all the ideas. You'll find that there's like 50 to 200 use cases or potential initiatives. Make that list. You'll be surprised once you start asking people around that there's a lot more ideas than the ones you could come up by yourself. And then there's a lot of work across teams to be able, this is part of the leadership interlock, to find out which are the best ones to attack now. And you create some scoring. This is part of laying out your AI program. You create some scoring to these metrics. So you might say internal is higher priority than external because it's lower risk. Then you find what's the biggest impact. Then you find another metric is how easy or how close are you to be able to deploy it, meaning there's commercial solutions already, or you already have a product at scale where you can infuse AI into it. So you just have to put all your scoring metrics there. You then, one of those metrics is going to be compliance and which have too many risks. So it's not worth doing, while some seem to be fairly safe. You create that battery of stuff and you prioritize. These are the ones we're doing this quarter. And you take it quarter by quarter.
So I think, Rodrigo, you said make a comprehensive list and then create a scoring based on whatever matrix might, because a matrix for you might be different than some other company, as you said,
Correct.
in internal, external, governance issues, compliance issues, et cetera. But that's very, very helpful, Rodrigo. Rodrigo, the AI landscape is constantly evolving. What prompted you to reset EY's corporate AI strategy, and how did you align the different teams across the company?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when I took on this job, it was, I believe, it was about a year before ChatGPT was launched. And what I ended up doing it was very much an orchestra conductor role when I took on the role, which is there were multiple teams across the company. I needed to bring them together. It was creating a dialogue, a community, and it was building a shared strategy. So that was really the focus. The focus was really a building a big tent where all the different initiatives and teams could live under one roof, exchange lessons, exchange resources. That was the mandate and the purpose of that exercise. I think most new CIOs might come into the role in a similar way, where there are multiple AI initiatives across the firm. They might be siloed under the business units, or they might be siloed under different parts of the technology or product organization. So it's really a community building, big tent building, and elevating the entire organization's efforts to the executive team on the board to orchestrate that effort better.
That is a very good point. And while you were doing that, how were you balancing innovation, because there's so much innovation going on, but also making sure that you are keeping safety and ethics in mind, because as you know, that's a big, big issue in there, Rodrigo.
Yeah. So when I was doing the role, this was again before the ChatGPT launch, we started out, we were basically working through what are AI principles. That's typically where you start, which is you make the list of 7 to 10 principles that are going to guide your AI efforts that you're going to adhere to. So we had done that, and we were working through the operationalization of those principles, which is how do we make sure we have the guardrails internally to make sure we follow those principles as we deploy AI. Now that we are in the generative AI era, there's a lot more eyes on the technology and the impact, and the technologies are also behaving more unpredictably. At the time, it was mostly predictive analytics. It was AI/ML, where if you run the, you train these models and you test them on the test set, you sort of know the behavior you're going to get. There are more stringent requirements on those models when they impact the financial sector. So you go through other additional tests. With generative AI, it's very different. The models might behave in much more probabilistic ways. So there's a greater need to have guardrails and responsible AI structures and frameworks in place. So we're doing that, and everybody should be doing those.
So Rodrigo, does EY have like an AI ethics board or something of that nature?
Yeah, we have a responsible AI team that makes sure we have the right frameworks, the right tooling. You need both the frameworks, you need the tools to be able to follow through with them, and you need the governance structure to make sure the work is resourced and gets done.
Can you just amplify that point for some of our listeners who are in the process or struggling with setting it up and how important that is?
Yeah, so I'll repeat the three sections. So you definitely need to have your principles and frameworks of what constitutes a responsible AI deployment and development, which will mean it needs to follow these principles. You need to be able to follow this methodology. You need to test them in these different ways. You can only, you know, gate them. The models can only be deployed in these specific gates with these approvals. Then you need the tools to be able to carry some of these things, because it's not trivial to test LLMs in different ways for responsible AI or AI. And there's a burgeoning industry of tools for RAI that are coming on the market. So you need to choose the vendors of the software that you're going to be using. You need to train your people in how to use them. And then you need the endorsement from the executives and the governance structure to make sure that there's endorsement both on the methodology and there's funding for the tools so you can have an RAI program that is adequate.
So excellent points you made. Have a framework. There are some tools now that are coming out. Pick one. Get C-level or corporate support towards this effort along with the budget. That's very helpful. Rodrigo, EY is a global operation, and a lot of our listeners are running global companies. How do you ensure AI solutions are scalable across global operations?
Yeah, so that's one of the things people who work in a sort of like sole jurisdiction don't see, which is the matrixing and the handholding across multiple jurisdictions is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
The more jurisdictions you're operating under means you have more regulation you need to follow and be aware of. regulation around the data, regulation around the AI practices. So be mindful of how much effort it will take to scale up an AI initiative across the multiple jurisdictions you work in, involve those people in those geographies. It is a lot of work. So I think the takeaway is it's hard and it's a lot of work, but it needs to be done. There's no two ways around it.
So it is a lot of work, and be ready to do the work of working across multiple jurisdictions, laws, regulations. Rodrigo, how do you approach, you know, I'm sure that's an issue when you talk about multidisciplinary approach. How do you approach the challenge of explaining complex AI concepts to non-technical stakeholders, you know, legal, finance, et cetera? I mean, this is what some of your peers want to know. How do you do that?
I think it's an art. You just have to use metaphors, understand their domain and what might be familiar to them. Try to get into their domain as opposed to bring them onto yours, because you're not gonna, you know, it's in your advantage that they understand your challenges and the way you work. So be generous with your time, collect a repertoire of metaphors that will be helpful in explaining the domain, but don't force a bunch of jargon and get upset if they don't understand you. That is not their job, to become AI researchers or scientists. That's your job. So I guess the takeaway is be patient, be thoughtful, be empathetic, use metaphors, and put in the time.
Key takeaway, use metaphors. That's what Rodrigo is saying quite a bit. Just as a follow-on to this, Rodrigo, a lot of, you know, as you know, there's large language models. In some cases are, you know, big black boxes. How do you approach the challenge of explainability or interpretability of some of these models, especially, you know, a lot of our listeners have mission critical applications in healthcare, in defense and security, just like you do in finance?
Yeah, so there, I'm going to sidestep that question, because I think that is there are technical tools to do introspection and explainability on these models. My guess is most of our audience, your audience, but you need to have someone dedicated to that task. That is hard. This is not, it doesn't come out of the box. Interpretability and explainability is hard. LLMs are more opaque. There's temperature settings you can change to make it be, you know, repeat their behavior versus be more probabilistic. But that's more of a technical question, I think, and a little bit out of my domain.
No worries, no worries. I might be asking a little bit of a technical question. If that is, please let me know. But this is something which is one of the topics du jour, Rodrigo. And you had experience, obviously, with foundation models and AI agents. Where do you see, because everybody talks about AI agents, agentic AI, et cetera, where do you see AI agents making the biggest impact in the next few years?
So from talking to people in our AI community, definitely agentic frameworks or AI agents are one of the biggest advancements in Gen AI this year, 2020. And I thought they would hit scale in 2024. It looks like they're going to hit scale in 2025. I think there's going to be what I'm seeing right now are two very different use cases or experiences. One of them is agents for consumers, and that's going to require the sort of more large companies that develop consumer tech to embed agent frameworks and have a developer ecosystem. And the typical conversation I hear is you have an agent and you want it to do your shopping, or you want it to send some emails and information requests, and the agent knows who you are. It can act in your behalf and it can interact with other systems to do the work for you. The enterprise side is the other coin, which I'm seeing a lot about, and that would be a lot of workflows that currently are brittle and hard to follow through, because basically you have tasks, the tasks are composed into a workflow, a number of workflows are a role. And workflows are very interesting because agents are, combining agents can lead to more robust versions. And when I talk to people in the community, they see it as a more robust version of what used to be called RPA or robotic process automation, that this might be the secret sauce that helps that vision become reality. So that's the enterprise side versus the consumer side.
So the consumer side, and as you said, and the enterprise side, and you thought, you know, this would be the year of the agents, but maybe next year. That's good to know. Rodrigo, one of the missions of our podcast is to democratize AI talent. Make sure that, you know, top AI talent just doesn't end up with the, so to speak, Magnificent Seven, because there are incredible organizations like EY doing some incredible stuff that we have heard now from Rodrigo and many others there in the manufacturing sector, in the healthcare sector, financial services, etc. And we've had all of them here. So this is a chance for the talent that is listening to you to you know, learn a little bit about the environment. So talk to them about some of the strategies you employ to, you know, create a culture of innovation within EY.
Yeah, so I think there is, I think I know what you refer to, which is there's a big concentration of talent in just a few companies. And what does that mean? Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing some of the concentration will sort of remain in that it's not just talent, but it's the budget to fund GPUs to create foundation models. That's not going away soon, the sort of vast sums of money and talent that are needed to build some of the foundation models. Fortunately, now we have a better balance of proprietary and open source models that perform at similar benchmarks. So the field is getting a bit more level than it has been in the past. But there's a lot of other roles in developing Gen AI these days than building a foundation model. And for those, there's opportunities in so many companies to deploy that talent, whether it is to build technology, whether it is to infuse AI into existing internal application platforms, whether it is to build agent systems, whether it is a business role, a product manager role, where you're basically trying to steer a product to growth that is now infused with AI. There's a lot of roles available outside of the technical skill set of building foundation models. And you should be able to find interesting roles across the world, across companies these days.
Well, that's very helpful. Rodrigo, what qualities do you look for when you are building your AI team?
Good question. I think I look for curiosity. Like a curiosity, and in particular with AI and with everything in general. It's an aspect that I don't want someone who just wants to do AI because it'll look good on my resume, but outside of the job, they don't care about it. You need to be honestly interested in the field. So curiosity is one. Hard work is two, because the pace is frenetic in AI. You need to be able to have the appetite to stay on top of it. And then the third aspect that I value is the ability to sort of self-manage, be entrepreneurial. It is such a fast-moving space that anybody who wants a very structured way of working and who wants stability, AI is not it. AI is changing every 3 to 6 months. It's very dynamic. There's a lot of pressure to move fast. So I guess it would be those. It would be curiosity, it would be hard work, and it would be entrepreneurial.
Oh, that's helpful. So our listeners, now you know what Rodrigo is looking for. Rodrigo, are there any relationships, partnerships that EY has done with, let's say, academic institutions, research institutions? I'm talking about AI or innovation labs or startups. This is, again, for your peers who are trying to figure out how do they stay ahead. Because all innovation doesn't happen internally.
Definitely not. Mm-hmm. We do have a lot of relationships with universities and with a lot of companies that are partners, whether they're large or they're small. I'm afraid if I mention some of them, I'm going to miss some out. And someone's going to be upset at me. But we definitely have a focused area on working with the best academic institutions and the largest companies and the most advanced startups. We are aware that it won't be all, that a lot of the great innovation happens outside the walls.
Well, that's good to know. So a lot of partnerships with academic institutions and research institutions. How do you approach, because as you just said, it's a crazy pace, frenetic pace of change in AI. How do you make sure your workforce, you know, the reskilling, upskilling, how do you keep that going? Because that's a critical component of what we are in the middle of.
Yeah, I think there's two aspects of the skill maintenance question. One of them is, how do you make sure that your technology organization stays on top of the pace of AI development, as opposed to fall behind? So that's one aspect. The other one is more the broader aspect, which is you can develop and deploy a repertoire of AI tools, but it doesn't mean people will use them. How do you educate your workforce on the best way to use these tools? I think the takeaway for the CIOs and the audience is, the job doesn't end with deploying the technology. The job ends when the technology is being used at scale and you're reaping the benefits that you set out to do. So you need to set aside budget for that part of the journey too. It's still within your remit.
So, you know, as you said, the job doesn't end deployment. Really is when it's used at scale. Rodrigo, tell me or tell our audience a little bit in terms of where do you see some emerging trends that shape the future of AI?
So I think the most interesting trend right now is the development of agentic frameworks. We're only at the beginning of that journey. For the listener who doesn't know that much about it, just recognize that these agent frameworks will have access to all kinds of tools that you give them access to. So they might have access to the web, to send emails, to do all kinds of work. You're setting them free in some sense, and that means they can do a lot of things they can't do today. So agentic frameworks is very interesting in terms of where they're going to develop. The other emerging technology that I think is unappreciated is the multimodal models we are starting to see, particularly the voice models. The expectation is that they're similar to what we've had before. The reality is, because the models themselves come with voice, they've been trained with voice and text at the same time, our conversations with them are very fluid and very different. They'll interrupt us, we'll interrupt them, we will interact with them in a very different way than we have done before. And that opens up a whole repertoire of use cases, of being able to talk to them, of them being able to see the world. So I think multimodal is the other aspect, which we're just at the beginning of that journey that seems very exciting.
Wow. So as you said, agentic, you know, agents and multimodal. Any quick thoughts on, you know, vector databases or synthetic data?
So those are becoming fundamental tooling for enterprise, particularly vector databases. They're part of the bread and butter of the technology stack. Synthetic data is different in that it's more used for privacy concerns to alleviate those. They're used for domain-specific data. And there's a lot of discussion in the community around we're reaching the limits of data that can be used to train foundation models in terms of the amount of data they're being consumed. So there's some discussion about what if we create vast amounts of data to train the next generation of models, but we don't yet know the quality of how those models turn out. But those are more vector databases are more bread and butter these days than synthetic data. It's another tool in the repertoire.
Awesome. We could be talking to you. I have so many questions that came in. We'll need to have you come back again, but I know how busy you are. So towards the end, Rodrigo, we have this lightning round of questions, one word answer, just for our listeners, your peers and others to know what you think. So are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. GPUs or TPUs?
Whatever does the job.
One of the things he talked about is to be diplomatic as a chief AI officer too. That's another skill. Python or R?
Python for me.
Okay. TensorFlow or PyTorch?
I think PyTorch is becoming a bigger standard.
Cloud or on-prem?
Cloud.
Okay. Biggest AI challenge, data or talent?
I think you need both.
Okay. I think you kind of answered this, but I'm still going to ask you the next big thing in AI, multimodal or quantum?
I would say it's multimodal and agent systems.
Okay. AI ethics, priority or requirement?
Requirements got to be done.
Okay. This one too, I kind of thought you kind of gave a little bit, display, you know, showed your hand a little bit. Open source or proprietary AI?
I'm happy we have both.
Okay. I think we've covered it pretty much. I mean, like I said, I can go on and on and on, but, you know, this has been just an incredible conversation, Rodrigo. Just been an absolute pleasure to have you. Finally, as, you know, we end this, can you provide some actionable insight or, you know, some of your advice to current CIOs, aspiring CIOs, or CEOs who are setting up AI shops in Fortune 500 companies?
I think the number one advice is this is not a fad. This is here to stay. If you're not on top of it, you're starting to get behind and you don't want to lag behind. So get in motion.
You heard it. Get in motion. As he said, Nike says, just do it. And that's what Rodrigo is saying. So Rodrigo, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. You know, your insights on leading AI transformations at Ernst & Young and your broader thoughts on the AI landscape are really invaluable to our audience. And thank you for sharing your experiences and shedding light on some of the exciting developments that are going on. And to our listeners, stay tuned for more inspiring conversations with other CIOs on the CIO podcast. Thank you so much. Rodrigo, this was fantastic. Thank you for taking the time and being so generous with your answers.
It's been a real pleasure, Sanjay. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you.